I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This afternoon, I have the distinct pleasure of being joined by Eamon Lynch, contributor for Golf Week. Sometimes show up on Golf Channel. You're on there. What would you say that is, a contributor on Golf Channel?
A recurring irritant, probably, but the best way to describe it. It's always a pleasure to be in the Egg House.
Yeah, we're coming here from Sand Valley. Just got done playing Mammoth Dunes today. Played the Sandbox yesterday. You played Sand Valley the day before. What do you think about this new Midwest destination?
The resort itself is fantastic. It's, you know, Mike Kaiser is about the only brand name developer in golf. And everyone knows what they're getting with Kaiser, which is a particularly elevated kind of golf. It's an elevated experience to be here. He attracts people who are particularly passionate about the game, and he's done that at Bandon Dunes, obviously. He's done it at Cabot Links with Ben Cowan-Dewar, and this place is a lot easier to get to than either one of those. So my guess is it's probably going to have a very strong future. I think they will announce the third course architect later this year. They already have two pretty darn good golf courses here right now and the Sandbox, so it's already a great destination.
Yeah, the proximity to Chicago, Milwaukee, Minnesota, Madison, yeah, it's by far the easiest of all the resorts. I think Stream Song, people say it's remote, but it's like 45 minutes from Tampa, hour from Orlando. That's a pretty easy one to get to too, but it's this golf course is a very cool place, and it's been amazing to watch it grow over the last couple of years. Like, I remember coming out here when they had 9 holes open of the original Sand Valley course, and it was just a trailer. And now every time I come back, I feel like there's 2-3 new buildings.
And none of it actually detracts from the golf, which you don't often see at resorts. You can go to a lot of great courses early in their lifespan, and then you see things get built up around them. And in a lot of cases, it tends to detract from the golf experience. And as you see it at Bandon, at Cabot here, the golf remains primary and nothing else that they add to the experience. While it adds to the general experience of being here, it does not in any way diminish or detract from the caliber of the golf. They don't line fairways with buildings or get it in the way. It's not intrusive in any way.
It's just interesting because I think with golf, everybody's always trying to do more to like make the game more interesting with their grow the game movement. And this is the model here is just like pure golf, and nothing detracts, or there's no add-ons to the golf like that are trendy or, you know, different. Like, they aren't trying to do any gimmicks here.
Yeah.
They're just putting the golf out and, you know, presenting the golf in a very elegant and enjoyable fashion.
But that in itself is growing the game. When you look at what they're doing, you go to Bandon and they have the punch bowl, they have the preserve course, here they've got the sandbox. That is a template for what ought to grow the game around the country. The first tee has not grown the game, is not growing the game, and will not grow the game. But if you have a town that has something like the Winter Park 9 or the Sandbox here, or even a putting course, you drive through North Berwick in Scotland and you see the kids' course there every night full until the sun goes down. And so what they're doing here is that kind of curiosity to a lot of golfers, but that's actually, I believe, the template for what could grow the game in this country, is to have more kind of concentrated experiences, whether it's a 9-hole course, a 6-hole loop, a mere putting course. That is how you grow the game, is to present the game with them. Stop dressing it up with this nonsense of teaching kids character and integrity and honesty, that's the parent's job. It's not a golf job to teach them that. And it's a cop-out to get behind these nonsense grow-the-game schemes that don't actually deliver anything. The PGA Junior League grow the game because they're actually out there playing the game. That is the goal, is to get kids out and play. And you just don't need 18-hole golf courses to subject kids to that at the deep end. We need more ways to entice kids into the game early with a limited but kind of immersive experience. And what they're doing here is kind of the template that should be taken for growing the game in other towns and resorts and municipalities around the country.
Yeah, I think so many golf courses should close across the country, but so many of them should look at...
Do you have a list?
I mean...
Do you work on them all the time?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them. But a lot of them should close their 18 holes and look at, like, how you could do, like, the sandbox, which is, you could do that on, what, 30 acres?
Yeah.
40 acres? You could do... There's Mike Clayton, Mike Cocking, Jeff Ogilvie's group at Shady Oaks in Dallas, I saw, or Fort Worth, I saw. They have this 9-hole course. You could route it like 9 different ways, or 7 different ways. You could have a different little 9-hole golf course every day of the week. Like, and on that course, you could hit driver on hole. You can hit, you know. To me, you don't need 18 holes. You don't need 150 acres anymore. Like, you need just something that is, that provides variety, that's fun, that's interesting, that is, you know, quality architecture, and that's going to get people back. Because Winter Park is a perfect example. It's jam packed. They've turned their business completely around. They went from a golf course that was losing $200,000 a year to one that makes money now.
And when you look at the actual cost to go and play Winter Park, it's actually just a nominal fee, even if you're not a city resident. So you also have to look at the economics and what it costs to maintain a bad 18-hole golf course,
mm-hmm,
versus a pretty good 9-hole course and maybe a putting course or some other addendum to it. It's a lot cheaper, and I don't necessarily think it would have a huge impact on revenue if it's done correctly, because let's face it, who wants to play a lousy 18-hole golf course? But there are people out there, I think, who are looking for a better alternative that takes less time, costs less money, and where they actually feel welcome and their kids feel welcome, or where women feel welcome. And that's not true of a lot of places in the country.
It's cool here they're doing that $5 for kids at the sandbox, $5 to go play their new 6-hole loop at Sand Valley. It's like, you know, that's a good way, you know, to get kids out and play good golf. I grew up, I got to play good golf because I worked at a really good country club. Like, and I got playing privileges, so I got to understand what good golf was. And that, to me, is so important. I think you play, the better golf you play and the more, you know, good golf that's available to the mass public is so important, because it's one of the problems with American golf is how private it is. And I mean, you compared to where you're from, Ireland, Northern Ireland, that, I mean, it's a completely different model.
Yeah, I grew up on a par three, an 18-hole par three course near my home, and I really should have taken it as an omen back then. I had a horrible slice and there was unbounds right on every hole. So I spent most of my childhood trying to protect my goods and services as I climbed over barbed wire fences to retrieve the only golf ball I had from the fields. But it cost the equivalent of about $4 to go play, and this is going back 25, 30 years. And my friends and I would go out there and we'd play 4 rounds in a row. It took us 90 minutes to go around. And that's what we did all day during the summer. And, you know, those things aren't particularly common, but, you know, every town and village in Scotland and in Ireland has a golf course. It's not necessarily going to win architecture awards, but people go out, they can go out and play in jeans. They're welcome to do so. They're just going to go out and slap it around. Kids are going to go do the same, but at least it gets them into the game. And I don't feel as though that's necessarily as much of a culture trait within golf outside of the UK. I believe it is in Australia, based on pros that I've talked to over there and my own experiences there. I think it's a much more open environment. But in the United States, there's, whether it's public or private, there is a tendency to, with the great courses, to build a wall around them and put up a sign that restricts who is welcome at any particular time of the day or night. So that's a culture that has to change if you really want to grow the game. But in this economy, bad courses are going to continue to close. So why not look for an alternative means? Why stick with the one model that has proven not to work? If your course is struggling, look for something else that might perhaps offer a chance at kind of remedying the situation.
It's crazy that if you had a donut shop that was, I'd serve identical donuts to the donut shop down the street, and the donut shop down the street just like got more traffic than you to keep doing the exact same thing. Like, that donut shop owner would change what he's doing in some sort of, they're doing in some sort of way, whether it's change a recipe, changes. But in America,
every donut shop doesn't have the same baker. And what the problem you have in a lot of golf courses, that certainly that in the last 30, 40 years, it's the same field architectural strategies that exist from one to the other. They hire the same guys to go around making the same mistakes that they made somewhere else because they've never bothered to go back and see how their courses play in the field and whether or not anyone enjoys them. I had a conversation with David Kidd last week for a piece I was writing in Golf Week, and he was flashing back 10 years when he was at probably the top of his craft, or widely considered to be then. He'd opened a bunch of golf courses, the Castle Course in Scotland, Tetherough, Stonebrae, Macrahamish Dunes. But he became very aware that his courses were winning much more in the way of awards than they were with fans, because golfers kept telling him, you know what, it was beautiful, I enjoyed the experience, but it beat the hell out of me and I'm not going back. So if you have an audience that would, even while paying you a compliment, would tell you they're not coming back, that should indicate there's a problem. And David eventually realized that he was off the path that he wanted to be on, and eventually, as we see here this week at Mammoth Dunes, found his way back to it. But that's a rarity among architects. Most of them continue building the same type of golf and offering the same kind of golf experience as they do everywhere else. It's regardless of the demographic that they're trying to appeal to, the town they're in, the topography they're working with, it really is the Xerox school of golf course architecture.
Yeah, municipal golf always seems to be the one that loses with golf course architecture because it ends up being boring. I don't think the golf courses here are necessarily a model for municipal golf, but there's a lot of things that you could take away from what they do here and bring them. You know, you're never going to find a municipality that has, like, you know, 20,000 acres of sand.
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to happen. And maybe not having, you know, 80-yard wide fairways that you have to, you know, maintain and cut is necessarily the best part. But having the corridors and the width that these places have is so important because, I mean, you've already alluded to your slice. It keeps you in the ballpark for a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think the value here isn't so much the practical way you can move the sand valley model elsewhere. It's kind of the philosophical underpinnings of it. And I think what Mammoth Dunes does is blow out of the water this notion that there has to be an antagonistic relationship between playability and challenge. That a course that is challenging to skilled golfers has to be punishing to the rest of us, which is a nonsense. And Mammoth Dunes proves it's a nonsense because the contours and the width and corridors that will keep someone like me in the round, albeit not today, is those are not the contours or targets that a plus two like you is going to look at. You're looking at a very different targets to try to work your way to the pin. And I'm out there on the edges just trying to stay in the game with the same golf ball I started with. That's eminently possible. I don't think you found it an easy golf course out there today. And that's the genius of this. You can actually have quality golf courses that don't need this kind of topography, but you also don't need the killer bunkers, the water hazards scattered at every turn. It doesn't have to be turned into some kind of medieval rack that you're going to stretch the golfer on for 5 hours. That's the philosophical underpinning of Sand Valley as it is abandoned, but particularly here at Mammoth Dunes, that's what's portable in this experience.
Yeah, I think there's like a big disconnect, and I saw it at Trinity Forest, and when you start to think about the idea of challenging golf versus hard golf. So like a single shot is challenging it. And especially at a course like Mammoth Dunes, it's out there. Like I look at that golf course and I think like, go birdie every hole. Like that's what the challenge is out there. And this is where I think it all comes back to the illusion of par and how people are obsessed with par. It's, you know, on one day, par should be completely different than the next day. If we play in a 30-mile-an-hour wind, the score of par is completely different than if you play on a dead calm morning the day after a big rain. Like, the golf course is way easier the one day. So, like, why is par still the same? But the idea of challenging and asking different questions throughout the round of players, and I think, you know, too many golf courses are too dependent on tee ball. Like, and I'd say my strength as a player is driving the golf ball. I like when they're tight when I play in competition.
And that's my absolute weakness right now, to the point where I might not ever actually play again. But this is the problem here, is that the challenge that it's asking of me is exactly the same as the challenge it's asking of you. And that's, to me, the cookie cutter one-note-ism that you see in a lot of golf. It would present its challenge off the tee, and it's going to offer you the opportunity to hit a difficult shot, and it's going to offer me the opportunity to hit an impossible one. And the cost to you of a slight miss is a lot less than it's going to be for me with a slight miss, because my margin for error is much greater anyway. And that's the problem I see in a lot of golf courses, that if a golf course does not have options, it's not interesting, and live or die are not options to me. And that's what you see in so many golf courses. You see it in Greg Norman's, in Jack Nicklaus's golf course, in Pete Dye's, in Rich Jones. You see it time and time again. It's just the same absolute dearth of options that are being offered to guys. You can see the challenge that's being presented, but they're presenting the exact same challenge and severity of challenge to wildly differing ability levels. And that just gets boring.
Well, it's the same question over and over again. It's hit it straight. I think, my most fun shot today that I played, I missed a green, and I had a really awkward lie on like the sandy native area off to the left of the green. I hit, you know, there was nothing in front of me on the way. And I could have hit a lob wedge, but I hit like a little pitching wedge pitch, like a chip and run out of it. And I kind of thought about it. It's like, if that was a deep bunker, I thought about the shot though for a while. And that is the fun of golf, is figuring out what you're going to do, not being told what to do.
That's also the fun part, is figuring out what the ball is going to do after it hits the ground, which we saw that at Trinity Forest when you were out there at the tournament. And how often do you actually get to watch tour guys have to worry about what the ball is going to do when it hits the ground? I remember I had this argument with Chambly earlier this year when he said that drive of Dustin Johnson's at Kapalua, which was whatever, 400 something yards to kick in range, that it was the greatest shot ever hit. To me, the one and only interesting thing about that shot was what happened when the ball hit the ground, which was probably 90 yards shy of where it ended up. And we just don't get to see that very often, where the elite golfers are forced to consider the contours and what's going to happen to the ball. We see it on tour every week where the ball hits, spins back to the hole, but it's basically hit and stop golf, which is just tedious beyond belief to watch.
Do you think that the venues the PGA Tour. How important is a venue to the golf tournament?
It's important to the golf tournament in the sense that they need to be able to accommodate the infrastructure that exists for a tour event. It's important to all but about three or four tour players only in the sense of, does it ask them to execute? They're not interested in a test of imagination. They are interested in a test of execution, and which is what separates this kind of golf here at Sand Valley from a lot of the other courses we see. But from a viewer perspective, I actually think it's quite important because you see this, it seems like the same event they're playing every week. It's the same guys at the same golf course being offered the same test. But they're just going to hit it as far as they can, gouge a sand wedge from the rough onto the green, and either make the putt or two putt and carry on to the next hole. And, you know, the guys on CBS or whatever are going to tell us you won't believe how difficult this shot is. Well, actually, we will, because we see everyone else play it all day long. It's almost like you're stuck in a groundhog day of watching lousy golf courses with boring golf being played. And that was what was so refreshing about Trinity Forest, is that it was a great break with the norm. And that was a tournament that needed to do something to kind of resurrect itself. And there are ways you can do that. Zurich did it by changing the format, and suddenly people have forgotten that the tour players voted that the worst course on tour a couple of years ago. And now another course that they voted as among the worst on tour was the AT&T Oaks course that they used to play the Byron Nelson on, which proved that
Colinas, the four season.
Yeah, that was the, wasn't that the AT&T?
Oaks course is at San Antonio. That's your boy Norman's, isn't it?
Well, again, they all met together.
Texas.
And the least offensive thing about that is the fact that it's named for a corporation. But, you know, the Byron Nelson tournament found a way to suddenly make itself the most talked about event on tour this year outside of, say, the Players and the Masters, because it found a way to move to an intriguing style of venue, and they took the risk of going with Coura and Crenshaw on that golf course. That draws in the tournament. And suddenly it's a very different experience from what we have been seeing, certainly on the Texas swing recently, but even on the tour in general. There just aren't that many interesting golf courses out there.
I think it's one of the, probably the three or four best venues that the tour goes to year in, year out already. Like,
and that's not a competitive category of kind of tour venues for start.
Well, I think what you alluded to that is fascinating is the idea of variety. When I look at the PGA Tour, whether it's the format, the 72-hole stroke play week after week after week after week after week after week, or whether it's the golf courses that are, you know, eerily similar in just different states. Having variety, I think, they should love that idea and do everything they can to go to different venues, experiment with different formats. And I mean, if you were running the PGA Tour, what would be the first thing you'd do?
Probably ban Kevin Na for slow play. And anyone else who needs, you know, 2-3 minutes to actually hit a damn golf ball. I actually think you can work with some of the venues that are out there. Part of the problem here is, a significant part of the problem, it's not the course, it's the setup. And the setup that the tour enforces every week is monotonous. It's asking the same questions every week of players on tour. So I think the tour itself bears some responsibility. It's not just on the architects here, or even the tournaments and their choice of venue. A lot of it is on the tour. So there is something they can do about that. I actually think they ought to. I think they should change some of the formats out there. I think the team event was fine. There has to be a better alternative to the 40-odd tournaments a year where it is 72 holes of stroke play, with a mediocre field that might get a couple of decent names in there, but you have to get an extraordinary turn of events on Sunday afternoon to really get the viewing audience interested. And you just can't have this kind of mediocre product as often as is actually presented out there. And that is not exclusively the problem of the course, nor even, I suppose, the exclusive problem of the tour, but it's something that they can and should address.
The setup thing's interesting because something I know players were really excited about at Trinity was the variety in the par threes, you know, having the short little guy on eight, yeah. And how every tour course seemingly is all 200 plus yard par threes. Just because there's a back tee at 200 yards doesn't mean they have to set it up that way.
And Graham McDowell got ripped by one of the Twitter trolls at Trinity Forest for taking a little bit longer than normal, because he's actually a fairly speedy player, to make an up and down on the 17th hole, because there were upteen options that Graham could have used to play that shot. And to me, the problem is not a guy who takes a little bit long to consider a wide number of options to execute a shot. The problem is every other week on tour where the guy who's been presented with one option still takes an eternity to play the shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that to me is the biggest problem in the game, actually, is slow play. That's really what the tour could address. And, you know, I could tolerate bad golf courses being played quickly, but bad golf courses being played at an achingly slow pace is just intolerable as a product.
And if you think about, like, what he was thinking about there, to me, that's where the broadcast sometimes misses the boat, is, like, the most compelling aspect of golf is listening to a player and a caddy talk about a decision where they're talking about where they're going to land the ball, what trajectory they're coming in at, you know, what type of spin they're going to have on it, because that... And that requires the broadcast to just not say anything.
Yeah.
I mean, and sit there and let the moment happen and then see what if the player executes the shot. Like, getting more, like, allowing that to happen more would be so, I mean, I think that's so compelling. I don't know if the regular viewer does, but that's how everybody can understand what they're talking about and see how good and how talented these guys are, where they're talking about landing at 150 or 148 at different trajectories with different spin. I mean, that's the talent of these guys.
Yeah, but getting the announcers to actually know when silence is of more value than words, I think, is a bit of a struggle, because ultimately they're paid to voice their opinions. And nothing can be settled until those guys have had their say on it. It seems, but there are a lot of times when it seems to detract from the moment of the broadcast. But again, I don't necessarily think you can legislate for the announcers. It would be nice if there was a little more awareness of what the viewer experience is. And I think that's also lacking quite often in the coverage of the game these days.
So it's crazy. We only have a little over 3 months left in the PGA Tour season.
Mm-hmm.
What's been your kind of takeaways so far from what we've seen, you know, Masters, players, and just the overall season? You know, we're about to hit the kind of the big events here coming up.
What's actually been surprising to me is how many of the biggest stars in the game have shown so much form this year. And yet we still haven't really had much in the way of those kind of toe-to-toe shootouts that we're all aching for, particularly in an event that matters. I mean, there was certainly a dramatic finish at the Masters, but Reed wasn't particularly challenged. It wasn't a go-for-the-throat kind of experience there, but there were a lot of guys playing really good golf. And, you know, we've seen Phil win, Rory wins, Tiger's showing signs that he will win again, which... Had you asked me that a year ago, I would have thought you were kind of crazy to believe that. But I do think he's going to win again. And it's shaping up with so much promise. We just need one of those kind of era-defining tournaments, which we haven't had in a very long time. Because to me, what the tour is missing more than anything right now is a rivalry. And yes, you can argue that it's great to have a dominant player, which we don't have. We have a lot of great players, but not a lot of dominant players. But go back, look for rivalries in this game. You have to go back to perhaps Greg Norman, Nick Faldo, 20 plus years ago, 25 years ago. Before that, you go back 40 years to Jack and Tom Watson. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's Anik and Gary Webb in there as well. But this game hasn't had the kind of rivalry that is fought out in the tournaments that matter. Nobody remembers Jack and Tom Watson fighting it out in the kind of Andy Williams San Diego Open. They fought it out in the Open Championship and the Masters and the US Open and events that mattered. And that just doesn't seem to happen in this generation. The best players are very seldom the two going at each other on Sunday afternoon in the biggest tournaments in the game. And that's what we need more, I think.
It seems like there's the parity is at an all-time high in the game, where if I put the top 25 players in the world in front of you for Shinnecock, would you be surprised if any of them won?
No, I think the pool of players who can win the biggest events now is probably bigger than it's ever been. But in some ways, the pool that does win seems smaller and less impressive. It's a great career now to have won a major. Jordan has three, Rory's got four, and they are by some margin the most dominant guys of that generation. Well, Tiger had a lot more than three or four at that point in his career, obviously. And you just wish that we could see someone stretch it out a little bit and see who comes with them. Let's find somebody who can add a couple of majors to their resume and see which of this generation has the stomach to make a fight out of it and elevate their own game. Because ultimately, a dominant player will elevate other folks. And you can look at tennis over the last 10 years and say, yes, Roger Federer is indisputably the greatest player who's ever played the game. But a lot of his career is defined by a rivalry against Nadal, mm-hmm. or Djokovic. He elevated them. They, at times, surpassed him. But it made for a compelling year in tennis every single year. Mm-hmm. Those were the guys who were there in the tournaments that mattered. And to me, that's our big loss right now.
Basketball's got LeBron as, like, you know, the undisputed greatest of this generation. But there's guys like Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, you know, that are pushing him.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that he automatically, and I agree. And part of me wonders, Tiger is the last dominant player. Mm-hmm. Will he be the last dominant player?
No, I think that kind of thing is cyclical. I don't necessarily believe anyone will ever play the game again at the level Tiger did in around 2000, perhaps even in the mid 2000s. When he was just demonstrably way better than everyone else in the game. He knew it and they knew it. But I do think we'll have another dominant player. It just seems it's a once-in-a-generation thing. I don't know who that's going to be in this generation yet, nor what will constitute dominance. Because you also have to remember that Tiger thoroughly skewed the perception of what the best player in the world ought to do week in and week out, because no one who held that dominant position before him ever did what he did week after week after week. And clearly none of these guys right now can do that. It's considered a hot streak if they play well 3 or 4 weeks in a row. Well, no, do it 52 weeks in a row, as Tiger did in his prime. So we see dominance, not at the level we did, but it would be a kind of a cheaper form of dominance, but somebody would get there again.
I go back to the dominance of Tiger has diminished ever since Pro V1 and the real distance of explosion. Mm-hmm. And part of me believes that, I mean, technology has brought everybody closer. Not necessarily the regular amateur player, mm-hmm. but from a high-level player perspective, there's no way you can't say that hybrids haven't allowed players to be better. And, you know, then, you know, the greatest skill, Donald Ross said the greatest skill in golf is the ability to hit towering long iron shots. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1900. If you talk to anybody about Seve or Jack, or Arnold Palmer, what the, you know, one of their greatest skills was hitting towering long irons. So beyond everything, you know, the hybrid technology, TrackMan, all of this stuff has contributed, I believe, to a homogenization of the game, to a slight bit.
Yeah, I think it's dragged. It's not that it's dragged the best players down. I think they're still the best players. It's allowed a lot of mediocre tour players to have very nice careers where they can play and compete at a very nice level without ever having to be great.
Mm-hmm.
Not that much has been asked of them. And the shots that separate the people who win tournaments and important tournaments are not demanded of players anymore. When you saw last year on tour, the longest iron DJ had into any par four was a 6-iron. So
once.
Yes, and I don't believe DJ can't hit long irons. He obviously can. He's among the two or three best players in the world right now. He's not being asked to,
mm-hmm.
and his distance is such that he doesn't have to. And I do think that's kind of created this pool of players that is miles wide, but about a millimeter deep,
mm-hmm.
out there when it comes to the ability to separate themselves from the pack. I believe even if we have, at some point in the future, bifurcation or a ball rollback or anything like that, I still believe the best players will be the best players at that point. What it will do is separate the also-rans who are skating by with technology rather than skill.
I believe like the top 15, 20 players will still be the top, you know, they will still be some of the top players in the game. Like they will, the top five will still be the five best players in the game. Where I think you'll see a shakeup is in the middle tier, where it goes back to what we were talking about with golf. Like I think that the ability to drive the ball is way overrated. I think, and from a viewer standpoint, a game with heroic recovery shots is way more interesting than a game where it's just a tactical precision game.
I like, challenge you to find a single golf fan anywhere in the world who can remember a great drive Seve Ballesteros ever hit.
Yeah.
But they can count chapter and verse of some of the short game shots that he executed over the years. Same with Tiger. You know, people remember the chip in Augusta. And they don't remember a lot of the 350-yard drives because they all look the same. They all end up in the same place. So the challenge is cookie cutter, whereas it's much more situational and involves many more options and a wider skill set to execute the closer to the business end of the hole you get. And I think that's where the real joy of watching this game and the great players lies.
What do you think of Aaron Hills last year?
That one I watched from afar, happily so. I just thought it looked like a fairly boring golf course. I thought it was a rather nondescript major championship. You know, I've always associated the US Open with the one that makes these guys squeak in agony, and that one didn't, except for Kevin Na complaining about the rough early in the week, which they then shot down. I just didn't feel as though it did not have the vibe and the aura of a major championship. Brooks Koepka, thoroughly deserving winner, wonderful player, but it did not strike me as being the kind of timber of the US Open that you've come to expect.
Why do we hold on to this idea of scoring with the US Open when the game's clearly changed?
Well, that's, I suppose, a question for Matt Davis. I'm not on the USGA Executive Committee yet, although I keep hoping that someday I'll get the call.
Have you applied?
I do not own a blue blazer, so that might be a problem. I don't necessarily think that challenge and scoring are one and the same. Perhaps the US Open folks do believe that, but I think Brooks Koepka would probably tell you that he found Aaron Hills challenging in last year's Open. But I'm damn sure there's a lot more guys are going to tell you that Shinnecock Hills is challenging when they get there in a couple of weeks. And it's a lot of it can sort of comes down to the course setup. I believe the USGA should move away from this idea of par and the defense of it. But again, then you move into the idea of the equipment issues and the distance issues. It's a real Pandora's box when you just try to define challenge versus scoring, because how do you rein in scoring or expand the challenge without getting into the way guys are able to overpower virtually any golf course? So then, do you have to grow in the fairways? Do you have to have rough that's waist high? You know, it everything seems to be interconnected in that argument, but it does feel as though there's a come to Jesus moment coming in that debate within the game of golf.
Yeah, it should be a really interesting next couple of weeks with arguably like the two sternest tests in golf. I think you put Oakmont and Shinnecock are probably the two venues in U.S. Open rotation that you would say are the toughest tests of golf over time. And then you go for the Open Championship to Carnoustie, which has long been considered the toughest test of golf. I'm fascinated to see, you know, what Shinnecock will look like. You know, the fairways are much wider than what they were before. I don't think that's going to necessarily equate to better scoring. I think it will separate the field better. It will, you know, the cream will rise more with the wider fairways there, because those players that are really on, that are hitting their spots, are going to gain the advantage. And, you know, when you get into these very, very narrow fairways with really thick rough, like, I mean, he had a great drive and catch like the side of the sprinkler head and bounce it into the rough. And he's like, well, that wasn't like a bad drive. And I think when there's more width, like the bad drives are still going to, if you had a bad drive with a wide fairway, you're going to still be in a terrible place.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it will be interesting to see if scoring is drastically different than 2004.
Well, Shinnecock is also one of those places that it really gets exponentially more difficult the closer to the business end of the hole you get. And, you know, it's got a pretty well-contoured greens. They're as fast as ice rinks, typically. It's beautifully bunkered. And what's interesting this year, I just talked to Brad Faxon about it last week. He'd been up there for media day, and he said it was quite interesting. I said, Curtis Strange, actually, he said how many of the areas around the greens that used to be just thick rough, which allowed you one shot to play out of it, which is hack it out onto the green. So many of those have now been shaved down into chipping areas. So I actually think this is an open that will separate guys who have that skill set close to the hole, because they're being presented with options on how to play it. And that's what I'm most looking forward to. I just say, put everyone in the middle of every fairway and let's fight it out from there. You don't even need to hit your tee shots.
You'd like that.
Absolutely. I think it would be much more entertaining golf, because that's what's going to separate the truly skilled players with nerves of steel than hitting drives into the fairway or just into the first cut of the rough and gouging it on from there. Let's put them around the hole and then see who's standing on Sunday evening.
See, that'd be an interesting alternative event, is it, if they did something where it was like a par 3 tournament, essentially, to see who is the best from 225 yards and then from all different kinds of places.
Yeah, and I think that's actually in a way, that's almost what the game has been reduced to at this point, because they all hit it a long way. It's not become particularly relevant where they hit it, because it doesn't seem to diminish their ability to score if they're playing from the rough versus the fairway. And it's the entire game has now become kind of a second shot and on sport. The problem is that in so many cases, what is presented to guys after they hit their second shot tends to be a very one-note challenge, and where the setup is the same most weeks and they're chipping from the rough. And, you know, Peter Costas is saying, won't believe how fast this putt's going to be afterwards. But at Shinnecock, if they have these shaved chipping areas and you're chipping onto those greens with those contours and that speed, I think that becomes an exponentially more interesting challenge than the idea of,
well, that's where the skill really, I like last year watching Aaron Hills had those shaved runoff areas. I'll never forget. I'm the biggest Lee Westwood fan in the world. And I saw Westy just out there with his putter, and I'm watching Patrick Reed chip in. Mm-hmm. And like Lee Westwood's just praying for a two putt from off the green, like just praying for par. And Patrick Reed's in the short grass, he's thinking chip in every single time. And that short grass really allows the short game skill to just be, you know, the greatest short game players love short grass. And the guys that struggle, they can't stand short grass. They're just grabbing their putter. They're playing defensive.
Yeah. And I think this is going to be the first Open really in a while that we see that. I mean, Erin Hills, I don't think offered as many options around the green or didn't demand as much of players around the green as Shinnecock will. And in fairness to the USGA, that was the first Open, to their credit, where they were relying upon the vagaries of the weather to help out. Now, you see that in the Open Championship every year. Mm-hmm. It may be the only defense those courses actually have now. Any course on the Open Rota, its only defense is the weather. And last year, the USGA was expecting wind, and it never came. So it just, they turned it into a pitch and putt course, those guys. That's not going to happen at Shinnecock because they don't need the weather to really fire up the challenge on that golf course. And nor does Carnoustie. They'll probably get it at Carnoustie, but they don't need it there. And I don't think they need the weather either at Shinnecock.
Mm-hmm. Who's going to win the U.S. Open and who's going to win the Open Championship?
Oh, boy. Not Phil. I don't think Phil ever wins his Open at this stage. We've played 117 of these things, and the number that have been won by 47-year-old men is zero. And I keep hearing
people, especially ones that have a propensity to drive it poorly.
Exactly. And that doesn't really set up. Now, you could also argue, does it balance out? Because Phil is pretty sharp around the greens with his creativity, that having those shaded areas might actually keep Phil in the game a little bit longer if his driver is a little bit wayward. I think you just have to look at guys who've got a really good short game. As odd as he's playing right now, I wouldn't rule out Jordan Spieth, because he's got the US Open seems made for that kid, because he's got a way of somehow, in that old school fashion, getting the ball in the hole. There's all kinds of ugly drama that goes along the way, whether he's on the driving range at Birkdale or he's just hitting it all over the shop at Augusta National and getting it done. He figures out how to get the ball in the hole. Whereas you have a lot of guys out there with a lot of prettier swings, a lot more confident, but when it comes crunch time on Sunday afternoon, their self-belief seems to waver quite a bit. And the US Open has a way of crunching guys' self-belief out of them. I could see Spieth actually winning, despite his putting issues, because on greens like Shinnecock, everyone is going to putt poorly by the standards of what they do on any given week. So the US Open has always kind of evened out the field, I think, in putting, because it's such a challenge for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And at Carnoustie, as they call it in Scotland, it's just a matter of, you know, who's going to be the most patient guy there. It's, you look at the last two Opens, there are two of the last three. You have Tom Watson in 75, you have Paul Laurie, Flinty Scotsman in 99, and Padraig Harrington in 2007. It's not an accident that those guys win at Carnoustie, because when something goes wrong, they don't sit and pout and have histrionics like a lot of guys on tour do.
So you're taking Bubba?
I think Bubba should probably book his flight home on Friday afternoon. But those guys, they're, you know, stoicism is a great trait to have in an Open Championship, because they tend to put their head down and just try to barrel on through whatever the challenge or disappointment is they've just been hit with. And that's the kind of character I would expect to come out on top again this time around.
Is Justin Rose a Hall of Famer already?
No.
No?
I don't think anyone is in the Hall of Fame with one major championship. And I don't count Monty's three senior majors as majors. If you have a title sponsor, you're not a major championship.
All right, let's get into some overrated, underrated here. Overrated, underrated, the performance of the winner of the 1998 Greater Vancouver Open. And this is from LeBron James.
I suppose it depends on what category we are rating him over, under. As a TV analyst, I think he's peerless. As a drinking companion, also peerless. As a nurturing golf coach, utterly lousy. But as a friend, pretty good. So I think it balances out on the positive side of the ledger for Mr. Shumbly.
Underrated.
I think he's a, yeah, I would regard him as underrated, but he's also undersized, so it's appropriate.
Swing demons.
Which one?
Just in general, are swing demons overrated or underrated?
Well, with me, they are. They're more overwhelming than anything else, because I made the mistake about 5 years ago of attempting to get better, and now I'm at the point where I almost no longer play. And Shambly has told me for years that I was uncoachable, and I think I'm on the cusp of finally admitting that the little guy might actually be right.
All right, overrated, underrated, chipping 6 irons. This is from Josh Labelle.
I think in general, it's an underrated skill, but when you were doing it yesterday on every damn hole in the sandbox, I thought it was a little overrated. I would have felt a little bit better about it if you'd at least worn shoes while you were doing it.
Are golf shoes overrated or underrated?
They're essential. They're neither underrated nor overrated. They just should be worn. No shoes, no service.
All right, Eamon. It's been fun having you on. We'll have to do something around one of these majors. But thanks for coming on. People can read your writing. What do you got coming up on Golf Week?
I got to write something in the next couple of days. What it is, who knows? I'll wait for the muse to visit. Maybe I'll write about my demons.
I'd like to know what they look like.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.